Group Meeting, Sunday, 22nd September 1985.
First of all, it is essential to bear in mind that there are purposes of our existence as such. We human beings are conscious only in terms of the finite and the temporal, not in terms of the infinite and the eternal. We are enclosed entirely within the sphere of mortality. All manifestation, in fact, lies within the sphere of mortality. Now, after the advent of the Neanderthalers on the globe, there arose races of men who had a development of the brain and a development of their sensitivity and refinement and so forth, which enables them to consider questions like, who am I? What am I? What is the purpose of my existence? Whither are we going? And how do we live in order to go that way? Such questions were being asked by human beings. And particularly during the last 6,000 years, or maybe a little more, answers were given. But those answers were given by people who had not developed a sufficient knowledge of the nature of things. That is to say, of the nature of the manifested cosmos. Few people, very few people, realize clearly that the knowledge of the nature of things is the most powerful determining factor in enabling us to express in concept and in word that which is realized in the deeps of consciousness. Since the knowledge of the nature of things is particularly the field of science, it is science which has helped man to find the means of expression of his inner conscious realizations, what we call his inspirations, inspirations in the true sense, in the profound sense, not in any superficial sense. There are, of course, inspirations which belong to the realm of art and science and philosophy, but there is that supreme type of inspiration which completely transforms our consciousness of things. And this is a point of the greatest importance as far as the fulfillment of one of the main purposes of our existence is concerned. You might ask, well, what is this purpose? I can put it in a sentence or two. If we examine the process of evolution of the human race, we will see that step by step, first through the millions of years, and then during the last few thousand years, man's consciousness is undergoing a steady change. He is moving towards a holistic consciousness, which functions in the context of the infinite and the eternal. That is, in the context of the immortal. Whereas our ordinary consciousness, which works in terms of the finite and the temporal, is completely confined within the mortal context. Now, to express this innermost development of consciousness, one must have the means for expression, and the means for expression that the human organism has is particularly concept and word. That is our means of realization for ourselves and for communication with others. Now, this change in consciousness is something which most people don't understand at all. They don't know that all our thought and feeling, our speech and our actions express that hidden, invisible aspect of our being, our inner consciousness. The manner in which we are aware of the universe in which we live, of our relationship to it, and so on. So, whatever is the nature of our own innermost consciousness, that gets expressed in our daily thinking and feeling, our speaking and our actions. So when this transformation of consciousness takes place, it is expressed completely through our everyday life. From a life in which man just is in a state of turmoil and he flits from one thing to another without any rhyme or reason, often just driven by the power of circumstance. From that kind of life, one changes into a life which is, in religious terms, the expression of an endless meditation, an endless communion with the totality. There is no question now of being in conflict within oneself or with the environment. There is realized that peace and harmony which really passes all ordinary understanding. It doesn't pass the understanding of the holy ones, of course, because they know what they are about. And then there is no effort in living the purely human life, which is no other than the ordinary secular life lived utterly virtuously. That's what it amounts to. So, through thousands of years, they have expressed these things with their affirmations as regards that state. But the affirmations as they stand necessarily must undergo change. If they don't undergo change, they become fixed dogmas and doctrines which are almost the curse of religion. Not the dogma itself, not the doctrine itself, but the fixation which takes place. That fixation has one good aspect only, that it carries the impetus for living the truly human life, the pure life, with it through the centuries. To that extent, it is useful. And it is useful for those who are not yet ready for that sort of thing. But that is the goal, one of the important goals towards which we are moving, this holistic consciousness, which is an all-inclusive consciousness. Our present consciousness is so exclusive. And that has to undergo the change, which will make it an all-inclusive, holistic consciousness. So now, this chapter 3 starts, scattered through the scriptures of the world, are affirmations of a great realization through all the scriptures. The poet seer, Pragatha, sings in the Rig Veda, "We have drunk Soma and become immortal. We have attained the light, the gods discovered. Now what may foeman's malice do to harm us? What, O immortal, mortal man's deception?" Now, of course, scholars, East and West alike, reading that, say these people must have been a very backward people. They had to take a drink and they became immortal. Bibbery never made anybody immortal. There are hints, of course, in the Vedas themselves. I'll read you the actual thing. In the eighth book, I think it is, of the Rig Veda, the seer says, "One thinks when they have brayed the plant," you know, the soma drink was the fluid extract from a particular plant. So you bray the plant and you obtain this drink. "One thinks when they have brayed the plant that he hath drunk the soma's juice. Of him whom Brahmins truly know as soma, no one ever tastes." Simply because it is not a drink. Soma is the personification, the god who personifies inspiration, who personifies this change in consciousness which gives the insight into reality. The insight insofar as that insight is possible to the human race. The supreme insights of human beings, constituted as we are at present, will never exhaust the truth. It will always be a beyond. But that lies in the lap of the future, a very, very distant future indeed. So, the unequivocal affirmations that the true soma is never tasted shows that the Vedic ritual symbolizes the inner religious life, the states of mind and the process of purification which culminate in enlightenment and communion. The scriptures are concerned with man's fruition as a religious being, not with botany. The draft of immortality is distilled in the deeps of the soul, not in a brewery. Soma leads to sanity, to perfect well-being. Bibbery does the reverse. All the scriptures uphold abstention from all narcotics and intoxicants. And so you see how important it is to penetrate into the inner meaning and significance of these affirmations. We have attained the light. Now, I would rather that we did not translate the Sanskrit word, the Vedic word, by attained. You and I, as individual beings, never attain or achieve immortality or whatever it is. Man attains nothing, that is to say, the existential being, we, the psychophysical organism, the person known in the world by our own name, never attains anything. Because all manifestation is transcendence concretized. You have heard me say this 1,000 times by now, that man is transcendence embodied. And it is not the existential manifestation, the psychophysical organism, which realizes or attains or achieves anything at all. It is transcendence which comes to flower through the organism and realizes its own transcendence manifested as perfect humanity, just as it manifests itself as the perfect oak or the perfect rose or the perfect gem or whatever it is. You see? It's like that. It is important to understand this, because unless and until we realize that there is nothing whatsoever for us as existential beings, when I die, that's the complete and absolute end. My I am I consciousness comes into being shortly, or perhaps it takes a fairly long time. It comes to comes into existence only after this person was born. Sometimes it's long after. Now, psychologists who have dealt with children and children's growth know this as a fact, that the I am I consciousness, which separates me from anybody and everybody else, comes into being well after I was born. Now that consciousness, in profound slumber, has completely disappeared. When you are in profound slumber, you do not know that you are you. And if, even in profound slumber, the I am I consciousness vanishes, and remember that the I am I consciousness is maintained by all the material factors which compose the organism and its activities and the properties of those factors, the brain and so on and so on. If even in slumber, deep slumber, that consciousness disappears, how much more so will that consciousness be completely gone when the organism is dead? This is rather, perhaps, it's too austere a presentation. People fight shy of it. They want a reward for themselves after death. Supposing that reward, strictly speaking, were hell, how would you like it? No, but I am a good fellow. Everybody in the world thinks of himself or herself, I am a good fellow, I am all right. It's the other man who is wrong. He's the devil. Now, assuming, and I would definitely say there is not in reality, but assuming that there is an after-death state, and I go to heaven, as we say, I'll see my enemies there, maybe. Because the judgment of the eternal may be entirely different, in fact, completely opposite to my judgment. The judgment of me, the existential being. So what will my heaven be like? My usual hell on earth? No, thank you. So we must realize that there is nothing for us as separate individual beings. It is this isolativeness, this separativeness in our consciousness, which we have to understand fully and deal with it. It is necessary first to develop ego. We have to bring our egohood to perfection. And the real egohood means that this psychophysical organism has been brought into a state of perfect health, of perfect harmony. psyche and body, they are absolutely inseparable. No body, no psyche. No psyche, no body. The two are one, but it is convenient to talk in terms of separation simply because our consciousness, being limited as it is, we can communicate only in terms of dualistic talk. That is the difficulty. It's this dualism to which we are confined by constitution. That is one of the reasons why even the holy ones had to speak in terms which were comprehensible by the limited intelligence of the people around them. All we can do in terms of talking, of writing and thinking and so forth, is to talk, write and think in terms which are less inadequate and less misleading. If we really saw that, we would cease to quarrel with each other, to argue with each other. Because this is all that we can really do. When you get the followers of any one faith saying that they've got the final, the last word, this is the word of God. The Bible for the Western world, for many fundamentalists, every word is truth, absolute truth. And if you ask them to expound that truth, you ask 100 such people, you will find that you'll get 100 different answers. And then they'll go to war with each other in the name of religion. And so forth. Well, all those absurdities would just go out of human life if we understood this sort of thing. Now, there is another rishi, and rishi means a psalmist. That is the best translation. A rishi is a psalmist. He sings the songs of eternal life. And anybody who calls himself a Maharishi is saying something which is a terminological inexactitude. Another rishi writes, "Place me in that deathless, undecaying world wherein the light of heaven is set and everlasting luster shines. Make me immortal in the realm where dwells the king, Vivasvan's son." Place me in that deathless, undecaying world. What is that deathless, undecaying world? Most people think of it as somewhere there, not here, not now. A world which is other than this. That is what they think and believe, unfortunately for themselves. The deathless, undecaying world is your own profoundest meditative state. In that profoundest meditative state, note carefully what I say, profoundest meditative state, there is a complete freedom from all the beliefs, ideas, formulations, concepts and so on, which fill our psyche. The psyche is empty. You know the Buddhist teaching of emptiness, of shunyata and so forth. This is the emptiness. It is empty of all these things. Why has it to become empty of all these things? Because all beliefs, ideas, words, thoughts, whatever you like, they all represent only the finite and the temporal. There are only a few words, literally perhaps only a score of words, in any and all the languages of the world, which suggest the infinite and the eternal. Words like infinity, eternity, they contradict finitude, temporality, and so on. Deathlessness, they negative the existential sphere. They negate the existential sphere without destroying it, remember. Because if in your profoundest meditative state you destroyed the existential sphere, there'd be no means at all of development and flowering out into what is man's divine destiny. You see? This is one of the meanings, if you like, of the mercy of God. So that is the deathless, undecaying world. In that state, you yourself are clearly conscious in terms of the context of the infinite and the eternal. Make me immortal in that realm where they move even as they list, in the third sphere of inmost heaven, where lucid worlds are full of light. Now, do remember that in all the old scriptural texts of all the religions, I don't know about Islam, there are some suggestions in the Quran too, but I don't know about them sufficiently to talk of them. In all the old scriptural texts, when they say the world or worlds, they mean essentially your own states of mind, of consciousness. That aspect of mind which is the supreme aspect of mind, namely consciousness. And consciousness literally means all-knowingness. Con, together with, and the shasness comes from skio, skire, the Latin, to know. And it is the all-knowingness, that state of all-knowingness. So the word worlds must be understood as different states of consciousness. If one understands these things and then reads the Upanishads and so forth, what seemed nonsensical otherwise becomes clear. Make me immortal in that realm of eager wish and strong desire. Now this naturally made many, many thousands of people, literally, rather upset, because one is taught to transcend all desire, to be free of the domination exercised over us and our lives by our wishes, by our likes and our dislikes and so forth. And here is one of the great seers writing in that realm of eager wish and strong desire. But if you study the Upanishads carefully, particularly the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya, you will find the key to understand this wish and this desire. It is that extraordinary hidden aspiration within one's innermost being to realize the purpose of one's existence, which is to realize that holistic consciousness by which one is in complete unity with transcendence. In Christianity, you have the Unio Mystica. The Christian mystics talked of the Unio Mystica and so forth. So it is in that way that we can understand a statement like this. Then again, make me immortal in that realm where happiness and transports, where joys and felicities combine, and longing wishes are fulfilled. Transports and felicities and joys. So many people take to drink or drugs and so forth, and they experience transports. When the psyche is completely empty of all the clutter that obstructs the light of transcendence from shining through you yourself, then that is a state of infinite, indescribable peace, harmony. It's a silence, it's a quietude. And that is something rich when you come back to ordinary everyday consciousness. In the ordinary everyday life, seems like something indescribable and so far distant. So you can, and one can use only the words available in human languages. And all those words, as I said a little earlier, are inadequate and misleading. They are not transports in the ordinary sense. You are not shaken, you are not ecstatic. This is one of the errors made by practically all the mystics of all the religions of the world, when they have talked of the ecstasy of that state. It is not an ecstasy. Ecstasy means being beside yourself. You are out of control. It is an enstasy. We owe the word, the continuous, nowadays, the continuous use of the word enstasy to the psychologists, particularly people like Mircea Eliade and Ken Wilber and others, who have had a real insight into this. And enstasy comes into being when you go within and realize the complete silence, the utter emptiness from all evil, from all disturbance. That is the ecstasy, you see. And we know how Orthodox conventional religions have misrepresented heaven, the usual orchestras of harps and whatnot. All that nonsense. There is no noise there. The music of the spheres is a silence. The actual physical spheres, the galaxies, make a peculiar hiss in their movements. This science has discovered it is not music in our sense of the word music. They don't play C, E, G and make a lovely concord or some such thing. They play C and C sharp together at the same time. Now, another affirmation by another rishi called Brihadeva. We haven't even finished the first page of the chapter. Brihadeva, the son of Atharvan, declares, he talks of himself in the third person. Brihadeva, the foremost of light winners, repeats these holy prayers, this strength to Indra. He rules the great self-luminous fold of light, and all the doors of light hath he thrown open. The name Brihadeva means great light, live, to shine. from the Sanskrit root div to shine, and brihad means expanded, grown to its full, to its fullness. So brihad diva means that. See, all those old names, you take Elijah or Elisha, Elijah, Eliyah is God himself, Elisha is God the Savior, Elizabeth is God the swearer. He never swears in dirty language. He makes a convention with man, you see. And he makes a new convention when man breaks the old convention, involving the mercy and forgiveness of Yahweh, and so forth. Elizabeth means God who makes this convention. But the literal meaning is God the swearer. And the son of Atharvan. Now this, the use of this word son, we have come across it in the beginning to Kashyapa, the son of Marichi. What does the word son mean in this context? It does not mean the son of the flesh. It could mean that, it may mean that, when it happened occasionally throughout history. The foremost disciple of the fully realized master was called the son. The Buddha himself says, "You are the children of my mouth." And in the Rig Veda, in the tenth book, there is a hymn in which the true Brahman is the son of, is born of the mouth of Brahman. It's very interesting. In that Elisha journey from Gilgal to the waters of the Jordan, at each place, Gilgal, Bethel, Jericho, Jordan, there are 50 sons of the prophet who are watching this journey. They must have been rather prolific prophets. And think of the expense of maintaining them and so forth. No, they were the disciples of the prophet. They are treated as their own sons, their own children. If I were a prophet, I mean of that caliber, then all of you are my children, my sons and daughters, but not sons and daughters of the flesh. Sons and daughters of the spirit. It's like that. And the son of Atharvan. Atharvan is the Vedic form of Atharvan. Atharvan, the Avastan Atharvan, was the fire priest. He who tended the fire. The fire priest, of course, tended the actual material fire. But essentially, fundamentally, it means the fire of creation, the spiritual fire of creation. The state of meditation, of pure meditation, the pure meditative state, is a creative state. It's the fire of creation which is action in eternity. That action is nondescript. I can't possibly give you any statements regarding that. I'm afraid we'll have to stop there today.